Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, working to assure opportunities for successful employment for all people with disabilities. A skilled workforce for Florida's businesses. The Able Trust. Empowerment, education, employment. On the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Governor Rick Scott wants Florida to scale back its participation in a multi-state testing consortium tied to Common Core due to concerns of federal overreach, but isn't quite clear on what that means.
But we're very focused basically on how do we continue to raise our standards, but say no to more federal intrusion or federal intrusions.
Also this week, more than a month after a Sun Sentinel investigation found holes in Florida's sexually violent predator program, lawmakers convene at the Capitol to debate changes to sex offender statutes. Some are calling for longer prison sentences. Others are arguing for more focused treatment.
Starting the treatment after the sentence is over is like taking an aspirin after you've had a migraine for 3 weeks. It doesn't really work.
We'll also learn what other hot issues surfaced during this legislative committee week as a tee-up to the 2014 lawmaking session. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Governor Rick Scott's executive order distancing Florida from a set of nationally adopted education standards has experts scrambling to figure out what it all means. As Lynn Hatter reports, while some are praising Scott for finally taking a stand on Common Core, others say his executive order amounts to politics, not policy.
In political parlance, Governor Rick Scott was for Common Core standards before he was seemingly against them. The Common Core standards have been criticized by both the left and the right recently, but for different reasons. The left is worried about more standardized testing, while the right sees the standards and their attached tests as federal overreach, a point emphasized by Governor Rick Scott himself.
It was their entry point to intrusion and how their involvement in our system. And what I believe in is that we should be able to come up with an assessment that that works for us. Again, we want high standards, but we don't need their involvement.
But when asked repeatedly to provide examples of how a test developed by multiple states represents a federal overreach, Scott repeated himself.
Give us an example of what you mean by federal intrusion. What specifically has happened?
It's the entry point where the federal government would be involved, more involved in our education system, and I oppose that. And that's why I talked to Secretary Duncan about, and I'm going to continue to oppose that.
But Abigail MacIver, spokeswoman for the conservative group Americans for Prosperity, is very clear about what she means when she says the PARC exams have been hijacked by the federal government. She points to the acceptance of $180 million in federal money used to develop the exams.
If we take that money, then we have to abide by their rules.
MacIver also points to a bulletin on the U.S. Department of Education's website, which outlines a review process for the Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers, or PARC, the multi-state group developing the exams. The consortium used federal money to create the tests, but new rules from the federal government in April are what really set MacIver and other critics off.
That they had created a seven-person technical review panel that is going to be technically reviewing all of the assessments and the curriculum that the testing consortia are establishing. So, again, they just continue, and they can do that because they've given those testing consortia more than $360 million.
Even though the PARC Consortium and, to a smaller extent, the Common Core Standards have come up with some curriculum recommendations, states don't have to abide by them. Under Scott's executive order, Florida will relinquish its position as treasurer for the group. But the governor stopped short of asking Florida be withdrawn from PARC altogether. He also did not ask the state to abandon the exams, which are set to replace most of the FCAT tests in the next 2 years.
I talked about avenues. And keeping all avenues open, and PARC was one of those and still is on the table as one of those
State Education Commissioner Pam Stewart is the one who will have to carry out the governor's executive order, which also calls on the department to hold a series of public meetings on Common Core. In addition to concerns over testing, several groups have also voiced problems with the standards themselves. Most of that has to do with concerns the federal government will try to dictate curriculum, the stuff teachers teach in the classroom. Those standards are already being taught to students in kindergarten through second grade, and next year they'll apply to all students. And some, like Florida State University political scientist Carol Weissert, view the governor's executive order as largely symbolic.
There are people, particularly Tea Party types, that are railing about the core standards. And so this responds to that, but doesn't really pull the state out of the group, but very symbolically takes a stand of concern against the core standards and blames the federal government.
Weissert says while she does not think Scott is pandering to his base, she notes criticism of Common Core has ratcheted up in Florida in the last 6 months and that Scott is paying attention.
The governor was in favor of it. Things change, circumstances change, but again, I think we're very close to entering into an election year, and I think this may be an issue that's going to be very dear, not only to his base, but a lot of people have kids in the school. A lot of people are very concerned about education. So it's clearly a very important salient issue. And what this tells me is this may be a big issue in the campaign.
And she thinks Common Core could play a big role in next year's gubernatorial race. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
The fallout from a Florida newspaper's investigation into the state's sexually violent predator program rolled on this week. Lawmakers in both legislative chambers debated possible fixes to a system some say lets too many dangerous offenders slip through the cracks. As Ryan Bank reports, lawmakers are looking to whittle down a long list of proposals to a few essential reforms.
Florida lawmakers held joint committee meetings this week to gather information on the state's sexually violent predator program, which has been under fire for failing to stop predators from reoffending.
Please call the roll.
Mr. Chair.
Here.
Senator Soto.
The Florida Department of Children and Families, which oversees the predator program, commissioned an independent study concluding that only 2% of offenders who were not recommended for civil commitment went on to commit another sexually violent crime. But DCF Interim Secretary Esther Jacobo says that doesn't mean the program couldn't use some changes. Among other things, she recommends employing evaluators to oversee the program's screeners.
Policies and procedures for the evaluation process are going to be reviewed and evaluated by a team and experts of stakeholders. We are putting together what that team will look like. One of the recommendations is, of course, that we invite more people into the review process so that we can really make sure that we're getting all views possible.
Lawmaker recommendations run the gamut. Some are calling for a review of plea deals, stricter offender monitoring, or tougher sentences. House Criminal Justice Subcommittee Chairman Matt Gaetz asked victims advocate Lauren Book if it would be beneficial to the community if offenders stayed in prison longer.
But if you increase the sentences, the amount of time people are in prison, then you decrease the amount of time that they spend in a treatment facility. If you come with the view that these folks cannot truly ever be cured, maybe they can be treated, but they can't be cured, is it a worthy policy objective to look at ways to rather simply extend their time in a state prison?
Book argues most sexually violent crimes go unreported. So although an offender may be convicted of one specific crime, locking them up longer is in society's best interest. But Suzanne Klein, the former head of the Sexually Violent Predator Program, says lawmakers should be wary of a one-size-fits-all mentality.
They were supposed to focus on the Jimmy Rice Act or the Sexually Violent Predator Program, but what they were really talking about were the gamut of sex offenders, which is a whole huge spectrum of individuals that are very heterogeneous, and a one-size-fits-all, any kind of legislation is not going to work.
Klein agrees with DCF Secretary Jacobo that the program is working but could be updated. She says adding an expert management board and halfway houses for high-risk offenders after their release might help. So too might treating an offender while they're still locked up. And many lawmakers, including Boca Raton Democratic Representative Irv Slosberg, agree.
The key aspect that separates Vermont from Florida is that all sex offenders receive some form of treatment, and this treatment process is started and sometimes finished while the inmate is already serving time in jail.
But Slosberg isn't sure there will be a willingness to fund program expansions like halfway houses, advisory boards, or in-prison treatment.
The problem is no one wants to pay the bill. I mean, we could stiff it on the state attorneys. We could move it around everywhere we want to move it around. But we as a committee have to be committed to funding whatever we're going to do.
Lakeland Republican State Senator Kelly Stargell and Plantation Democratic Representative Katie Edwards filed the first bill dealing with sex offenders Wednesday, but it doesn't address medical treatment or evaluation of the offenders. Instead, it makes illegal for them to possess pornography. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
Join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. Still to come on Capitol Report, the first bill passed out of committee would start the legislative session 2 months early.
So there's really just kind of a very short time to not just deal with new budgetary realities, but with new laws.
State lawmakers were in Tallahassee this week doing some pre-legislative work, including taking a look at some criminal justice reforms.
The court has said that it's unconstitutional to give a juvenile a life sentence without a meaningful review of that sentence, and so we'll be looking at that legislation this year.
After ousting and then selecting a new Democratic leader designate, House caucus members say they're ready to start working as a team. And some of Florida's top financial experts agree too many of the state's kids, and even their parents, just don't know the value of a dollar. A few months after Governor Rick Scott signed into law stricter ethics regulations for lawmakers and officials, the legislative committees that drafted those reforms have begun outlining new priorities for this year's session. For one, Jessica Palumbo reports, the Senate Ethics and Elections Committee is looking into whether the legislature should have more oversight of local boards that collect property taxes.
In Florida, more than 200 special districts collect taxes based on property values and use it to perform a variety of functions, including developing a downtown area, running hospitals, protecting beaches, or funding children's community health organizations. A small number of those district boards are appointed by the governor, and an even smaller percentage of boards also need confirmation by the Senate.
Now, we have water management districts that have ad valorem taxing authority and basin boards that have ad valorem taxing authority. Those are all, you know, subject to Senate confirmation.
Ethics and Elections Committee Chairman Jack Latvala says there's a handful that don't undergo that scrutiny.
And I'm just raising the issue as to whether or not there's some sentiment to treat them similarly.
A report prepared by committee staff shows boards performing identical functions in different counties are not subject to the same vetting process. Miami Republican Senator Miguel Diaz de la Portilla says he sees that as a potential problem.
It is a good idea to require Senate confirmation of appointees that will be in a position to affect people as directly and as powerfully as anyone who affects property taxes or makes a vote or a decision on property taxes.
Kurt Wenner with the government watchdog group Florida Tax Watch says overall, special taxing districts are already beholden to the people they serve because the vast majority are elected locally, not appointed by the governor. But he applauds Senator Latvala's investigation, even into such a small number of districts.
One size doesn't always fit all, but there should be some uniformity with important things like how are the boards elected.
But he says the locally run and operated districts might not take kindly to any changes.
Whenever the legislature gets into local issues, you tend to get pushback from local governments because they want to retain their control.
And changing the board confirmation process for all boards might not be so simple. That's because some of the boards are created by local ordinance, not state law. An updated report will be presented to the committee for further discussion at a November meeting. And the same committee was also the first to approve a bill for the 2014 legislative session, moving the start date of the legislature from March to January.
The fact that it got
a hearing so very early on in the process, I think, is positive.
Miami Republican Senator Anitary Flores sponsored the bill and says the idea seems to be gaining steam after it died last session because it didn't have a House companion. She says the permanent move occurred to her during a redistricting year when session began in January. She says she heard from school districts how grateful they were for the extra time.
That process usually happens about the first week of June for the budget to be totally finalized, and the fiscal year begins July 1st.
She says the shift would give agencies 3 months instead of one to adjust to having more or less money and to figure out how to implement new laws. But even if the bill dies again, she says she hopes to encourage conversation among lawmakers about whether they're using their time efficiently, especially during pre-session committee weeks.
The early committee weeks tend to be very light on substance, and I think that's problematic. I'd like us, you know, to be more focused every time that we're in Tallahassee, doing the people's work and making sure, you know, it's expensive to send us all over to Tallahassee for a week of committee week.
In opposition to the bill, Democratic Kissimmee Senator Darren Soto says he fears holiday conflicts would cut into time for committee weeks leading up to the January session. Even with his no vote, though, the Senate Ethics and Elections Committee passed the bill 11-2. Its House companion, sponsored by Miami Republican Representative Jeanette Nunez, is not yet assigned to any committees. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Florida's Stand Your Ground law, sentencing reforms, and reentry programs for inmates are just a few areas on the agenda for the legislature's criminal justice committees during the upcoming legislative session. Sasha Cordner reports on the priorities expressed during this week's committee hearings.
An update on prison health care privatization was the subject of several committees, including a Senate criminal justice budget panel. Florida Department of Corrections Secretary Mike Cruz says it's been a long time coming, but the effort expected to save the agency millions of dollars should be finished across the state by mid-October.
I won't say that it wasn't without some hiccups. When you're talking about the significance of this, IT issues, staffing issues, that was our primary concern, that our members were treated fairly. And, of course, contractually, that a large portion of those members were retained by the providers.
Still, he says delays due to a court battle had a negative impact on the agency's budget. Unions sued the state on behalf of thousands of employees who did not want to lose their state jobs. Cruz says he didn't have a concrete number for the legislature on his department's deficit, but he's still looking for other areas where the agency can save. That includes having correctional staff do their own pest control and inmates making their own clothes instead of buying them. Meanwhile, over in the other chamber, Cruz Deputy Assistant Secretary of Reentry Chris Sutherland told House Judiciary Committee members that it's been a struggle getting ID cards for newly released inmates.
Documents that you need for me and you need right now to go down to get an ID is a Social Security card, a birth certificate, and two proofs of a residency. And sometimes we have problems with that, and we don't have a record. So you can just imagine we know this is an issue.
The House Criminal Justice Subcommittee will also discuss sentencing reforms for those convicted of drug-related crimes and crimes against children, and following up on the Timely Justice Act, a law some say speeds up the death penalty process. The panel's chairman, Shalimar Republican Matt Gaetz, says there's a fair amount of housekeeping ahead.
This year, we're going to deal with the Stand Your Ground issue. We're going to deal with reforms to violent sexual predators. There's some pretrial bond issues that we're going to address. There's juvenile sentencing. We've had some Supreme Court decisions where Florida's laws aren't compliant with juvenile sentencing. So those are some of the items that we'll be dealing with over the course of the year in the Criminal Justice Subcommittee.
Besides the Florida Sexual Violence Predator Program, the most widely anticipated hearing for Gaetz's committee will be when he takes up Tallahassee Representative Alan Williams' bill to repeal Stand Your Ground. Gaetz says he'd hope to convene the hearing next month, but scheduling conflicts with Williams have pushed the hearing back. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Unity. That's the picture House Democrats are trying to paint following a leadership shakeup this week. And Regan McCarthy reports while experts say, while the party isn't there quite yet, they think it's likely the lure of winning the 2014 gubernatorial election will help the members get on the same page soon.
During a closed, hours-long Democratic caucus meeting, group members voted to remove St. Petersburg Representative Daryl Roussan from the line of leadership succession. Questions arose about Roussan's motives when he started a fundraising committee that only he could control without telling anybody. Roussan says he sees now he should have been more inclusive, but he also says he doesn't think his actions were fairly portrayed.
What I always asked for was don't judge me or condemn me 48 hours after an email goes out from Florida Democratic Party.
As the heir apparent to be Florida's House Minority Leader, Roussan was heavily responsible for the caucus's fundraising. And University of South Florida political science professor Susan McManus says when money's involved, it's not unusual for people to be sensitive about how the purse strings are held.
When you have issues that involve money and, that becomes an issue about who has the power to raise it and spend it and so forth, those are always things that create doubt among some in a party and distrust among some.
And McManus says it's also common to see leadership changes after a major party election, like the presidential election. She says in Florida, Democrats had to focus not on local races, but on trying to keep it in Barack Obama's column.
When parties were very up to high speed, and so, the year after for the winning party is sometimes filled with turnover, so it's not really unusual.
And McManus says the Democrats have a more disparate base and more groups to answer to than Florida's Republicans, which she says is another reason the party tends to look less organized. Meanwhile, current House Democratic leader Perry Thurston called the shakeup a family disagreement. He promised Democrats in the House are a unified front, but less than 2 days later, party loyalties were split again. Members cast secret ballots for either Tallahassee Representative Alan Williams or West Palm Beach Representative Mark Pafford to be their next leader.
The clerk will call members' names as they will proceed to vote.
Pafford won the vote by a fairly large margin, meaning he'll take over as House Democratic leader when Thurston's term ends. Williams says he's glad to have participated because it helped him get to know the 43 other members of his caucus better.
Some that, I don't get a chance to talk to a whole lot. And I got to understand some of their frustrations, some of their concerns, and some of their expectations.
And Pafford says he'll be able to get the group marching in the same direction.
First priority is unifying the caucus, getting some good legs underneath the caucus. I mean, we've got a lot of work to do in terms of making sure everybody is included and inclusive, both internally, making us stronger on the issues, bringing information, to each individual so they can make the best decision and hopefully represent their districts real well.
And McManus says she thinks Pafford's right. She says winning a gubernatorial election is too big a prize for Florida Democrats not to unite.
Humpty Dumpty always gets put back together again when it comes to a governor's race and parties in Florida.
A spokesman for the House Democrats says there will be one more ceremonial vote to cement Pafford in his position closer to when his term starts. And he says there's the chance the House Democrats could select a different leader then, too. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy in Tallahassee.
Florida lawmakers are remembering their former colleague, John Patrick Julian. The former South Florida legislator lost his battle with cancer today. Ocala Republican Representative Dennis Baxley worked with Julian when he was the ranking Democratic member on the House Criminal Justice Subcommittee. That was a panel Baxley chaired. Speaking at the end of a recent committee hearing, Baxley mourned the loss of his friend.
And it's a heartbreak for his family, I know, and we want our prayers to be with them, and I would just ask for you to observe with me a moment of silence in honor of our wonderful friend, Representative Julian.
In a statement, House Democratic leader Perry Thurston called Julian a great friend and public servant. Julian served just one term in the Florida House from 2010 to 2012. The 50-year-old tried to run again, but became embroiled in a battle with Democratic Representative Barbara Watson over their newly redrawn House district. He took the matter to court to contest his loss, but the court found in Watson's favor. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. As a high-ranking official with the Florida operation of the financial giant Raymond James & Associates, Jeff Simon knows more than a little about money. He says the big problem is that too many other people know far less about money than they should.
If you go back 60 years ago, there was 1 out of 1,000 foreclosures in America. Now it's 20 out of 1,000, a 2,000% increase. In the last 30 years, bankruptcy in America has increased 650%. Why is that? Well, people just don't have the fundamentals of personal finance to avoid these catastrophes.
Chris Cummins, who's in the financial division of State Farm Insurance, says similar sentiments. He says it's not just financially literate individuals who benefit.
If you look at many of the socioeconomic problems that face our state, that face specifically our young people, and you think about the impact that that could have not only for them, but for generations to come, folks, I know of no better topic for us to rally behind to get these young folks in a spot where they can make the very best decisions.
And Anthony DeMarco with the Florida Bankers Association says financial literacy doesn't have to involve complicated calculations and arcane fiscal folderol. It can be as simple as realizing how easy it is to make lots of money a little at a time.
If you started working at 21, you retired at 61, say for 40 years, you would save, I think, something like $75,000 with compounding of interest of just $100 a month doing that. And that's the power of compounding and the power that these students and Floridians need to learn.
Traditionally, it's usually been parents who have taught their kids the value of a dollar and the basics of wise money management. But an August summit of Florida financial types quickly concluded too many parents today don't know much about money either. So earlier today, members of the Florida Council on Economic Education summoned the Capitol Press Corps to the state's Press Association media room.
Really, our purpose in gathering is to advance support for a required standalone semester course in personal financial literacy, which we're calling the Money Course.
The council's Mike Bell says this isn't the first time there's been a push to introduce standalone financial literacy instruction into Florida classrooms. The legislature has toyed with the idea before, but the all-consuming drive to beef up standardized test results in elemental skills such as math and reading have pushed proposals like this aside. Also, cash-strapped school districts have been reluctant to add any curriculum elements that cost money. In this case, Bell says that's not a problem.
There is ready availability of partners, resources, and training so that a course in financial literacy, the Money Course, can be implemented at little to no cost to local school districts.
Which may be the most important financial lesson of all as far as Florida lawmakers are concerned. Members of the Florida Council on Economic Education expect their bill to have at least a fighting chance during the 2014 session. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Bank, Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, committed to helping high school students with disabilities graduate and advance to jobs, post-secondary education, and a bright future. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment, on the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.